You're listening to the HyberCloud Podcast, where the forecast here is always compelling as we discuss real-life challenges, successes, and stories from the journey to HyberCloud with your host, Andre Tost.
All right. Welcome, and thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of the HyberCloud Podcast. And today's guest is Tanveer Syeda Mahmood. Thanks a lot for joining, Tanveer.
Thank you.
So Tanveer is an IBM fellow, of course, and she's also a chief scientist at IBM Research. And her job title includes working on multimodal bio-inspired AI. So that's obviously quite a mouthful. And obviously, we're going to try to get to the bottom of what that really means. So maybe as always, let's start out with some introduction. And if you could tell us kind of your background, you know, how you, you know, the things you've worked on and how you got to be what you are today, and then also maybe a bit about what you are doing today at IBM Research.
Sure, Andre. Happy to talk about my journey in AI, which started, I would say, probably around 1985 timeframe, when I started work in speech signal processing under a professor in India who worked on the Harpy system for speech understanding in CMU, long before Dragon and every other things came along. And now you have those in production systems in Nuance and other companies. So that was my first foray into AI. And then when I came to the US to join the MIT's AI lab in 1988, to study AI, as you know, this is the place to go for AI. They told me that AI is over, you came too late, and there's not much happening in this space.
So this was in 1989, you said?
1988.
AI was over by then, right?
Yes, it was over by then, by from the AI lab standards and what was going on in the general community there. The hype for AI was at a low from the capabilities that could actually be demonstrated. So in that atmosphere, for me to pick up a PhD research in AI was a risky effort. So the first year that when I had lab fellowship, I tried different areas of AI. And the first was knowledge representation. And on day one, when I entered and talked to a knowledge representation professor, Dave McAllister in those days, he described a problem to me in monotonic reasoning and showing that it is decidable. And that exciting work actually led to one of the earlier papers in knowledge representation that essentially showed that monotone inference relation was polynomial time decidable. But anyway, I was not interested in theory, so I moved on to the next project, which was working with Rod Brooks in the AI Lab Olympics that winter or fall of 88, where I worked with a mechanical engineering student to build a robot, which then became, I think, the origins of the first vacuum cleaner robot that Rod Brooks went on to make, iRobot and the Roomba that you now see in the market.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that was the first, that was in robotics. And then I landed in computer vision with Eric Grimson, who is now the chancellor of MIT. And that's how I got into computer vision and stayed in that field for a number of years until I was the program chair for CBPR in 2008. And over those periods, we started getting into applications of computer vision in healthcare. And that's how the next 15 years I have stayed in healthcare. And in doing each of these, we have led different fields. And the last foray in this was to introduce AI to radiologists through the Eyes of Watson exhibit we did at RSNA, which woke up this community for the importance of AI in radiology. And in particular, by that time, AI was heating up again with all the models that came along in computer vision led by it. Interestingly, vision came back to be a very relevant field again. And now with the latest, once the work in healthcare has, as we moved on from there to new areas, I brought back my background passion in neuroscience, which is one of my thesis subjects, along with AI and trying to apply now to the latest, bringing these fields together in the context of hybrid cloud to look at new architectures for designing storage systems that are based on exploiting the human computational models of the memory system and brain.
Oh, wow. So maybe I missed that. So when did you make the transition from MIT to IBM, and how did that happen?
Oh, from after graduating from MIT, I went actually to Xerox Research. So I've always been in research labs or academia. So the Xerox Research is when I did the content-based retrieval work, which helped launch that field prior to the deep learning-based computer vision. And this work was actually, while I was doing this work at Xerox, IBM was actually doing Cubic, which was the query by image content project. And that was one of the leaders in those days, long before Google Image Search and others came along, and still one of the most cited papers in there. So I wanted to join that group that was actually at the center of these. And that's how I came to IBM in fall of 1998. So that's about 25 years ago.
Okay. Even though it sounds a bit like, which obviously would be great, it sounds a bit like you got to pick the areas of research you want to work in, and then you found the right place to allow you to do it, so to speak, right?
That is correct. I've been fortunate in, you know, just going into a new area that I think might have a potential for research and basically carving out a space and raising interest in that topic and rounding up the usual suspects to collate around an idea and then helping launch the field and then taking it to commercialization and then doing this all over again. So I'm in that cycle now with this new project on BioInspired AI.
One thing I'd like to touch on a bit is you know, as you were explaining the areas that you worked on, it always seemed like they were crossing the boundaries between what gets articulated in software ultimately in whatever form and the physical world, right? Even starting out with a vacuum cleaner and robotics and then going into vision, right? Which is also, I can think of as vision or the interpretation of images as a software-based kind of idea, but then making it stick in the real world, so to speak. So is that a correct assumption that you're kind of balancing both worlds?
Yeah, I mean, I'm an engineer at heart, you know, with the base degree in engineering and all. So I do like to make things that work and that people can actually use. So while good at basing them on sound theory as well. And if you see the flavor of most of my work, it is perceptually guided. So closely following how, humans are trying to come up with ideas in this space or approaches. So while it's not necessary for AI to emulate humans exactly the same, but learning from humans is still, there's a lot of room in AI for. So that has been the philosophy in designing approaches to working systems.
It also seems like how you're describing it, and you just said it, you're emphasizing the human factor in AI, right? To basically take something that humans do and try to at least simulate it or mimic it or copy it in the ideal case. So would that also mean that something like machine learning doesn't necessarily fall within your definition of what AI is? Because machine learning is not trying to simulate human behavior necessarily.
Yeah, and that is one of the reasons why you see it has hit some roadblocks now in terms of capability. There are some tasks that are very easy for humans, still very difficult for machines. And of course, vice versa is also true. There are certain computations and things that machines can do harder for humans to do them as quickly. But when it comes to social interactions, when it comes to understanding the nuances and the subliminal feelings that we have, and AI is still not there yet. And either it will do aggressively a stance and say, this is what I feel or this is what I do. Whereas understanding that need at a finer granularity is where AI is struggling. And a lot of it is reflected when you go to domain experts And this is what we felt in the field of radiology. Getting machines to recognize some findings is good, but doing this at a level of proficiency that you can actually put in clinical practice is yet another bar to reach. And capturing that fine-grainedness in AI is still an endeavor that researchers in AI are trying.
So that sounds a bit like we've become pretty good at simulating the senses, so to speak, like what our eyes see, what our ears hear, but we are not very good at interpreting that, what we've heard, because that's where emotions and semantics in general come into play here. And so you just mentioned just judging something, saying this is good and this is bad, you know, that's where the real intelligence kind of starts to apply.
Yes, I mean, you mentioned the word semantics in there, and this is one place where I would like to emphasize that the current data-driven approaches to AI are hitting some limits in terms of exhibiting intelligence that is workable for everyday use. All the impressive demonstrations you see through, you know, ChatGPT or any of these language generative AI approaches, if you were to read between the lines there or try to really understand what they're saying and decipher what is fact versus what is fiction, you will see that the level of understanding that they themselves have in generating the text is limited. So even at the level of simple level of semantics to know if you are asked to retrieve pictures of cats and knowing cats are a type of felines, and then if you don't have pictures of cats, you can retrieve other felines as a viable alternative, is something that we as humans would do if we didn't have access to the data that someone is requesting. But that level of inference to know what two things mean or are semantically related is something that we don't quite have yet.
I think what is almost a distraction, in my opinion, of this whole generative AI discussion is that people typically, because we're all, you know, because everyone's plate was ChatGPT. And what I think of as the distraction there is the chat interface itself, namely the fact that I can now interact with the system in human language and it gives me human language back, right? But I feel like that is distracting from the actual content, right? From the actual creations that are being done by the models in the background. And so I find it interesting that all of a sudden, you know, the fact that we can try to argue with a machine through a natural language interface, that is what takes people to believe that this is a brand new thing, even though I feel like the fact that we can now interact with it in regular everyday language, that's been around for quite some time. What's really new is kind of what comes back, the content that comes out, that it can assemble pieces of information in ways that haven't been there before. So I always feel like a bit, I wish the discussion was less about the chat, but more about the GPT portion of it, so to speak.
And in fact, if you talk about generative AI versus discriminative AI and where they're respectively used, I think the current bandwagon has been to focus on generative AI and the ensuing applications, but there's still plenty of discriminative applications where such architectures may still be useful if you focus on the GPT part, as you said, like if you look at the not the decoder aspect of it, but the encoder aspect of it as well.
Because one of the use cases I keep hearing people mention is for this kind of interface is summarization. And I'm thinking, okay, and that doesn't necessarily impress me all that much, to be honest. I can see the usefulness of it, right? Basically, because it augments a gap that we have as humans is that there's only so many books you can read in a day. But if there's a machine that can read the books for you and give you a valid summary of that, there's value in that, right? But that's not creating anything new. That's just dumbing it down.
Yeah, I mean, those applications for end users versus enterprise applications, if I think of where do I need generative AI, clearly in healthcare, if you could automate reports by interpreting imaging and have the clinicians correct those reports, that would significantly speed up clinical workflows. But they have to be pretty good to be accepted in there. So factually correct and reflective. So the two things have to be true there. Not only should that report be factually correct, in other words, some impossible combinations of findings shouldn't be there in the report, for example, but there should also be a good correlation with the image that you are seeing. So that double constraint is actually what's going to make these kind of generative models, put them to the test, really. And so there are domains where if you use them wisely, you can have applications. But the current state of the technology, despite its impressive examples, I would be nervous about using it in enterprise applications like search, for example, where the high levels of precision are needed.
And isn't a problem with this that it's inability to admit that it doesn't know something or can only give you some information with a very low level of confidence, right? So I feel like that's often missing from things that come back from ChatGPT, that it would say, I'm only 30% sure that what I'm telling you is actually right. It seems to be eager to make stuff up and to fill gaps. And I'm not quite sure why, because it gets in the way.
Yeah, I mean, it is partly a design consideration. If you should look at what it is really doing underneath, well, we don't have very good descriptions of GPT-4 anyway for the what is underneath. But from the general understanding of that area, it is in the generative part, it is navigating through a space of possibilities. And from the prompts that are given, if it hits good anchor points, your answers may be good. But if it lands in some weird anchor points, it may go off in one direction or the other. And from one place to another, you could get increasingly weird. And that's why you see those conversations where the ChatGPT or the equivalent software acquires their own persona.
How much of a role do ethics play in all of this? So I work in security in IBM, right? And so we use machine learning models for all kinds of purposes. And there's very little discussion about things like bias in there, because you could say, how can you be biased against an IP address or something like that, or a piece of malware that's going around? That's the space that we're in. But I feel like as soon as you add humans to the equation and you're making statements about humans, it becomes much more sensitive. Now, my impression is that whole space is mostly being given lip service, not entirely, but mostly, in my opinion, where it's never holding anything back. It's not allowed to hold back technical progress of what can be done. And everyone says like, oh yeah, but we're going to make sure we're doing this right, and we're going to deal with this later, right? So there seem to be lots of promises in that space. I see fairly little action in that space. How much of a role does it play in the things that you do?
So we recently did a report on a 10-year outlook on AI within IBM. And one of the areas that we looked into were benchmarking data sets and how they are required for AI tasks. For generative AI as it is, it's very difficult because if the content is de novo, how do you benchmark it against a matching to a ground truth or so? But even so, even for discriminative tasks, or rating the level of intelligence of a machine, the data sets that need to be required have to have a lot of rigor in them, which we don't see as often. And that's why you see noisy data sets and people accumulating data set wherever they can get it, rather than a careful collection process. So yes, you can take such noisy data sets and then apply filtering techniques to clean them up for bias or in bad content, etc. But more importantly, what is a good data set that everyone can agree on is if machines did well in this, you would reach an acceptable level of performance and equivalent operation level for as humans. For that one, it takes a lot of effort. And one such example we did was in our chest X-ray work, where to say that the machine has passed the Turing test for interpreting these, we actually had to generate a data set using a triple consensus process with adjudication. And that alone for creating for about 2,000, 3,000 chest X-rays it took a year to do, just to get enough clinicians to agree on findings for sets of chest x-rays so you can label them as a proper ground truth, as a gold standard. So I don't, if unless we do that for other domains like this, we're going to have a lot of hype about the technology. And once again, when it comes to put the technology to actual practical uses, you will hit those limitations. And again, there will be some disappointments with AI.
And then again, you know, I completely agree with you. And I feel, though, that's not getting us to take a step back and maybe slowing things down. I mean, I'm outing myself as a fan to some of these calls that have been made to, you know, slow down maybe or even suspend, you know, some of the technical progress that's being made on some of these models without having those things cleared away. I'll give you the most basic example. A lot of the examples for biased models are based on when they relate to humans or based on race, for example, right? I'm not an extensive user, but I've used DALL-E for image generation, text to image generation. And I go in and when I say a person or a man or a woman, at least in my experience, that's been 100% a white person is created as a result of that, right? So you could make an argument that that's biased to begin with, right? But then again, I don't have the feeling that we're actively, that everyone is saying, yes, we need to fix this, but no one's actually interested in really fixing it.
Yeah. I mean, and in this case, the reason for the bias is the data set that it was trained on had a majority of that distribution. And that goes back again to how do you train such models and how do you benchmark such models? So benchmarking was an example I gave, but training, it is similarly true that you have to carefully acquire data sets that are having those distributions and the balance in them. And then sometimes it might mean throwing away some data so that you achieve that balance. And that's also something we had to do in the medical imaging world. But there you have the opposite issue. We don't have enough data, so you can see, take what you can get. But in other domains, you have plenty of data from which you can filter for these to reduce it to good data to train on. And oftentimes you see, even in the latest Flamingo model, for example, they trained on a combination of bad data and some good data. And the logic of that is not clear to me. When you mix up bad and good data, you would expect to see overall noise, right? So still, that would dilute the effects of it. But people are trying different strategies in trying to see, come up with performance in the race for those numbers.
I want to switch the topic here a little bit, go back to something that you mentioned earlier, that you've been between academia and, I don't know if that's a word, even commercial research, you know, if you're doing research for a for-profit institution like IBM or Xerox, as you mentioned earlier. How would you characterize that? And so I guess what I'm curious about is, are you ever tempted to like go back to academia because maybe there's less pressure on commercializing things, or but the funding isn't as good, or you know, where do you stand on that? How do you make the call? What would you say to an up and coming scientist as to, you know, stay in academia, publicly funded educational institutions and research institutions, or get with a company that has deep pockets because that will allow you to do more?
Yeah. I mean, interestingly, as you know, in AI publications, if you go to conferences, the field is dominated by industry now. Now, a few years, 10 years from now, maybe that may not be the case, but a lot of people getting trained are entering the industry space. So I think the general opinion is industry is a good place to be for such researchers. But my personal opinion and the reason why I chose to be in industrial research labs was to sort of have the best of both worlds. It's joining research labs like IBM Research gave me the opportunity to do some fundamental science and look for long-term, long-range projects that have where I can envisage impact, and not just immediately, but a few years from down, where we can incubate technologies. And as you said, not have to worry about grant writing all the time for fundraising. And yet, in IBM Research, we actively collaborate with academia, and I have a lot of students I work with and co-publish and faculty collaboration. So in that sense, we are getting the flavor of being in academic institutions while still getting the freedom to do research and not have to worry about funding. That is one. And as well as getting involved in professional societies and all, we stay actively involved as well. So with IBM research, there's not that much, you know, difference if you see between academia and staying in an industrial research lab. Having said that, the biggest downside is the horizon over which we do these and what happens from if you want to be a scientist remaining in a deep field of expertise for a very, very long time, you can do so in academia. Once you get tenure, you can probably just keep continuing to work in that area. Whereas with industry, priorities do change. As you know, we moved away from healthcare after being maybe the fourth or fifth time in healthcare. And so when that happens, then people do need to change direction and shift. But fortunately, we have collected a range of expertise over the years that applying it to a new domain or problem is not that much of a change. But still, it is a bit of a distraction if you were to think of it from keeping your focus on the field.
How do you decide if something you create, intellectual property you create, should be protected because we may want to sell it versus sharing everything you do with the world? So for example, do you ever come to the point where you said, I've had an outcome of a piece of research and I would like to write a paper about it and publish that paper in some scientific channel? And then someone saying, you can't do that because we would like to patent it and because we might productize it and then we want to be ahead of our competitors. Or does that never happen?
Yeah, I was just thinking the way we typically write papers is we come up with ideas, we do the work fully, prepare a paper for a conference or journal, and then write the patent. So that way the patent description is made easy because we already have a paper and description to back it up. And we've already conducted the experiments and all to prove out the technology. And then we send them out for review to conferences and file and go through the disclosure filing process internally. So that kind of gives us, for most of my papers, we have patents that are guiding those. In the field. So, and particularly in healthcare, when IBM was in healthcare and commercializing, many of them had commercial implications. So we were able to do both.
I didn't even know that was possible, to be honest. I always thought once you've published something and you told the world about it, you can't patent it anymore. It has to go the other way around.
Yeah, that is true. But what I mean is the whole process takes, because the conference review process is easily 3 to 6 months, depending on journals for that matter. So by the time, and submitting to such forums is considered confidential review. So it's not public disclosure. So until you get it accepted and then you present, the day you present at the conference or it made available in the proceedings for open viewing, it's not considered publicly disclosed. So that gives us sufficient time to get the both of the ducks in a row. And there have been cases where we had to file very urgently because our paper was being presented. And there have been situations where we worked through weekends to get those filed in time. Yeah.
Okay. And that's not to say, obviously, that in academia, they're doing that too, right? I mean, in academia, patents are being filed just as well.
Yeah, the constraints on patents has not been an issue. And nowadays, I think the IBM has loosened up on patents as well. So we are doing more open source and releasing, publishing the work more and more. But yes, I do believe that there should be intellectual property protected if you have the secret sauce that makes your technology and puts you as a leader in some space, then protecting this is important. And that's why I have filed a fair number of patents in my life. But I think that will be important, particularly if they're embedded technologies that gives you that secret sauce.
So we're basically out of time. I don't want to let you go before I ask the final question I always ask is if you could give us an example of something really cool and exciting that you're working on right now to the degree that you can share. something that makes you want to get to work in the morning because it's really cool stuff. Or it could even be outside of work.
Okay, I will say something that I am, you know, passionate about, but it's not as probably as relevant for IBM. And that is this is the same idea of the neuroscience inspired work that we have been doing for building hybrid cloud storage systems based on bio-inspired memories. We have an application of the technology for serving as memory prosthetics for memory impaired individuals who, as you know, Alzheimer's patients oftentimes forget who their children are. And so the, you know, the ability to remember while there is cures being thought of by, you know, chemical means and others, affecting the quality of life through AI by giving them a memory surrogate so that it observes and it looks at what they are looking, hears what they are hearing, and is able to give them feedback to help them remember. That's what we call as memory prosthetics in this bio-inspired AI team that we are actually working with Stanford High's students as part of the collaboration with Stanford. That is, to me, you know, a meaningful application for human use for some of this bio-inspired AI technologies.
Yeah, I have to admit, that sounds really, really cool. That might deserve another podcast episode all by itself. I had no idea this even existed, but yes. That's intriguing. Okay, but we'll save that for some other time. Like I said, for today, we're going to wrap it up. So let me thank you for being here and giving us that insight. That was really cool.
Thank you.
And with that, we're going to come to a close for today's episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening, as always, and I hope to see you all soon. Bye-bye.